My name is Dario Hasenstab, and I'm here with Balder Hagretz, and we are back with the Western Bubble podcast. Today, we will talk about institutional failure, particularly with a focus on universities. Hi, Balder. Why are we speaking about this topic today? Why are we talking about institutional failure at universities?
Hi, Dario. Well, this is actually the first in a three-parter, where we're also going to talk about the institutional failure when it comes to foreign policy and broader conversations like that. And this is in line with what we've done in the past. We had one specific episode on institutions, but a major aspect of the Western bubble is this belief that the West will survive, that the West will just continue to thrive and continue to be this light on the hill for the rest of the world to follow. And more as time goes by, we see evidence that the West is actually relatively fragile, that the lack of vision, the lack of focus, the lack of solidarity, if you like, is leading the West to be in decay and possibly in the future collapse. So then that conversation about institutions, about how Western society works domestically, has significant impact on the rest of the world. And that's why we're doing this today.
And what are the facts?
Since October 7th, there have been protests across Western and global university campuses in support of an end to Israeli violence in Gaza. However, in the month of April, these protests intensified and student encampments became common across the West, including UCLA in the United States, Sciences Po in France, and the University of Queensland in Australia. These protesters have a large range of demands, most specifically wanting the universities to divest their endowments from Israeli companies or companies who do business with Israel, cut ties with Israeli academic institutions, and formally call for a ceasefire in Gaza. The protests are generally non-violent, although universities broadly see the protests as creating an unsafe and potentially dangerous and anti-Semitic environment for students, and charge protesters with trespassing. Some universities have resorted to calling city police to clear encampments, most notably and violently at Columbia in New York and Emory in Atlanta. Over 2,000 students and 50 faculty in the US alone have been arrested, and many arrested by police on campuses have no affiliation with the university they are protesting at. The presidents of both schools have had votes of no confidence initiated against them by faculty in the aftermath. Not all protests have ended in violence. At Brown, the university and protesters negotiated an agreement to end the encampment, and at Ghent University in Belgium, the university even gave in to three demands, severing ties with Israeli institutions.
What is the bubble?
So when we talk about these protests, and we're really not talking about a few, right? So we have a bunch of encampments or protests at universities in Australia, the United States, the United Kingdom, and Canada, and even in countries such as Jordan, Lebanon, Egypt, Germany, France, right, in Finland, but also in India, Japan, all the way to Latin America, in Argentina and Mexico. So this is, I mean, I don't know. I wasn't there in the 60s, but can we compare this to the protests at university campuses surrounding the civil rights movements?
Well, yeah, possibly a slightly more globalized version in terms of where it is taking place. However, I would argue that the 60s civil rights movement, even though there are clear similarities, was very different content-wise, right? It was about a conversation about what kind of society we needed to live in, what kind of vision we had for the next generations, who we wanted to be and what we wanted to be, whereas the protests right now are on a relatively narrow issue, namely Israel and Palestine, without much of the philosophical or sociological conversations that you could see in the 60s. On top of that, I would argue that the tone is also slightly different.
The tone is definitely different, right? I mean, everyone who has been on the internet in the past few weeks has seen images, particularly of those police, right? I don't know, raids or interferences with these camps and encampments. And there were, I mean, we also saw very unfortunate images or videos coming out of these encampments when Israeli students were, right, being slurred at or were even like refused entry. I mean, with these protests, usually you have the more convinced people at these encampments. And those are not always the smartest cookies in the jar, right? They sometimes go way over the line. And with this, in the end, they do not really benefit their movement or their demands. If anything, they hurt them.
Yeah, I think there are a few things like that to unpack here. So this is always a problem in demonstrations, protests, that you have a wide range of voices. And you've got, if you like, the very moderate voices. Moderate doesn't, by the way, necessarily mean good or bad, right? I mean, sometimes it's time to be radical. Sometimes it's time to be moderate. But you've got moderate voices who just want, you know, Israeli policy to be a less violent, less aggressive against Palestinian people. And then you've got the very radical extremist voices who basically want to burn down Israel, who want to even burn down Western institutions. And putting that all together is problematic because the moderate voices get drowned out and it becomes unclear what the message actually is towards society. So that's one important thing to unpack. The other thing to unpack here is that this happens in a 21st century where everything is a little bit more aggressive than, for example, the 1960s protest, right? Knowing that we were going to talk about this, I went back to some images from the 60s and 70s from my country. The Dutch protests, student protests, were actually relatively early from a European perspective, very much in line with the US civil rights movement. And if you see the way that the police and protesters interacted in the 60s, it was a completely different story. It was much less violent, much less aggressive from both sides, right? From both police and from protesters, much less antagonistic, more like, hey guys, can we cut it? Can we stop it? Can we just please be kind to each other? There were normal conversations rather than military police surrounding campuses and protesters with masks shouting horrible things at the police. In that sense, all of this, what we're observing right now in 2024, is displaying an aggression and a level of violence that doesn't bode well for our society.
And this is not the first time that we have been observing this, particularly in the last five years. Yeah, really, it's really been the last 5 years. I mean, we've had the Black Lives Matter movements, particularly in the United States, and they're very quickly, it also turned very ugly and very violent. And we've seen the exact same problem with the climate movement, right? Where usually you have like a big crowd of people, kind of all the moderate voices, right? Kind of all saying, hey, we want to generally move into this direction of society. And then institutions, right? So particularly here in our case today, universities, but I mean, in these other cases, then maybe police institutions or government institutions not responding like directly to them. And then things turning ugly very quickly with either violence across the board. And then you see these terrible images of raids happening or of people gluing themselves to, I don't know, runways on airports or throwing tomato sauce at paintings. So we've seen this pattern, particularly in the last 10 years.
Yes, the tone of the two sides has become much more militant. I would argue that the two movements you mentioned here, Black Lives Matter and the environmental movements, at the very minimum, certainly Black Lives Matter, let's focus on that, have a certain parallel, obviously, to the civil rights movement from the 60s. Namely, there's institutional racism, there's institutional oppression of African Americans in the United States, and you could probably cover similar issues here in Europe. And to say, hey, something desperately needs to change because we are being killed at the moment. That is a very different kind of conversation than what's happening right now on campuses in university, where it's about a specific foreign policy, where it is basically middle-class Europeans or Americans, North Americans, standing up and saying, we are against Israel and we are for the Palestinians and we want Palestinians to stop being oppressed by Israel. That is a very different kind of conversation. And a much more complex conversation because it happens within a foreign policy, international relations perspective that is not their own society. And so you would hope for a little bit of modesty and a little bit of reasonable discussion, certainly when compared to something like Black Lives Matter, which is directly about your own society.
And I mean, you would expect that modesty and the discussion particularly being started, initiated by the institutions. Because, I mean, let's be honest, on the one hand, you have young students, I know, in their early 20s, maybe late teens, who, I mean, feel very upset about the world, right? Feel very helpless also in a sense, because there's nothing you can do yet. You learn about these things on a daily basis. You see them very vividly on the internet, right? That's also a big change to the civil rights movement. And then it would be up to the institutions, to the university, to say, okay, let's sit down. Let's have a, I don't know, town hall format, and let's discuss these things. Let's hear your worries. Let's hear your concerns. What are your demands? Are these demands reasonable? Can we put them into perspective? Can we maybe even implement them? Can we help you to kind of voice kind of the change you want to see? But that's not necessarily how the universities are going about this.
Yeah. And that, in that sense, I think this episode is a little bit problematic for us because we are not satisfying either of the two camps, right? We're basically saying this is a plague on both houses because universities and the establishment over the past 6 months has been relatively tone deaf when it comes to younger people demanding change and not feeling comfortable with pro-Israeli policy in the way that older generations feel comfortable with. Politicians, and again, certainly in Europe and in the United States, have basically dismissed almost all criticism as basically being anti-Semitic. And then at that moment, you shut down any conversation and you shut down any feeling of these students, and it's not just young people, but right now we're talking about students, feeling that they've got a way to connect to the establishment and to change things from within the mechanisms of society. And if you feel that you are not heard by institutions, by the establishment, yeah, then you start breaking down the establishment, you start breaking down institutions, and you stop respecting the law, you stop respecting university decorum and those kinds of things. So in that sense, we can't just put the aggression down to the protesters. We also have to look at how universities and governments, politicians, media are completely dismissing the vision and perspectives of younger generations.
And this is another pattern. I mean, again, I always talk about the last 10 years simply because that's the time frame that I can observe. But that's a pattern that we've seen in the past too, that it's really easy to dismiss other voices because of some radical elements amongst them. I mean, we've seen this during the climate movement, right? We see people saying, oh, we now need to stop living, basically. We need to go back to the Stone Age. We saw this during COVID, right? Where criticisms of or concerns about lockdowns, about maybe even vaccines and so on and so forth, were dismissed that, oh, well, then you're just a vaccine. Like, you're just a COVID denier. I don't even need to talk to you. It's very lazy thinking from the institutions. It has become, I assume, that type of behavior has become more and worse. I mean, you can observe this a little bit better than me, but it does feel like this, that, I don't know, as long as I can remember now, with most crises that we've faced over the last 10 years, whenever someone, like, there were critical voices, they were not heard, they were not even engaged with, they were usually just brushed aside as radicals.
Yeah, and I'm obviously not old enough to talk about the 1960s, but what you can clearly see is that since I was a student, since the 1990s, there has been too much within institutions and within political circles, this narrative of we now know what is right and what is wrong, and we don't really need to have any more conversations about it. We no longer need to have conversations about where we go as society because we figured it out. We don't have to worry anymore about philosophy or about ideology because, hey, we are the West, we are liberal, and we can just get along with each other and everything will be fine. And those institutions basically dismiss any important voices coming from the new generations. And here, I suspect, and again, I wasn't alive in those days, but if you read literature about the protest in the 60s, you had an old generation, an old establishment that was institutionally, for example, racist, but it was led by middle-class white people who couldn't see the racism, or at least who didn't want to see the racism, let me put it like that, because it was comfortable for them not to worry about it because they weren't the victims of it. The civil rights movement made them panic. It made them basically, oh, what does this mean? And they couldn't connect necessarily to the movement, but they were afraid and they were concerned and they responded first relatively aggressively against it, but then slowly started having conversations because they understood that something was not quite right. Whereas now in 2024, there's almost a kind of arrogant dismissal by institutions, right? There's almost an arrogant dismissal of, oh, no, you're just young nitwits. You don't know anything about life and we don't have to pay attention to you. And that is very dangerous because the more you don't pay attention to these movements, the more those movements are going to grow and the more supporters they're going to get. Just like the Trump movement in the United States, Make America Great Again. Initially, that was dismissed by the establishment like, oh, you're just a bunch of idiots. What do you know? And then all of a sudden, 80 million Americans vote for Donald Trump. The same with Brexit. The same with all those kinds of things. The establishment has a certain inherent arrogance these days that basically dismisses anything that falls outside of their scope. And that makes the protesters even more angry and even more extreme and even more counterproductive, because then they start wearing masks and they look like Hamas. And all of a sudden, there is a gulf that can no longer be bridged between the two sides.
Well, that's the thing, right? I mean, the past 10 years, I feel like we've almost alienated every single group out there. Right. So, I mean, let's talk from a European perspective. I mean, 2015, we had that whole migration thing, right? Where, I mean, at first, I vividly remember this in Germany, that in 2015, in the fall, right, when Merkel made the decision, hey, we will take in 1 million refugees. That at first, there was this, the whole country said, yes, we can do it. Yes, Merkel, we trust you, we believe you. And then we're critics on the side who said, well, I mean, 1 second, I mean, 1 million at once, isn't that a little bit much, right? Shouldn't we separate this all over Europe and so on? And then they were disregarded as the populists on the far right, right? So crazy people. I mean, then we move on. We saw COVID. COVID and Black Lives Matter at the same time, right? So now you have the next group, Black Lives Matter, you have the next group, alienated, basically, kind of saying, you know what, yeah, you have you and your racism. No, we solved that in the 60s. Please leave us alone, you radicals. Okay, next group alienated. So now you have the people on the right and maybe more towards the center-left alienated. Then add COVID to that. Now you have people, I mean, on all sides of the spectrum really alienated, even more from the middle class. Add to this now Israel-Palestine, you have people on the left side of the spectrum alienated. At some point, the middle is going to be gone because everyone will be mad at the institutions.
And this within an environment where that anger gets fed by social media. You know, oil gets thrown onto the flames every day because these protesters get into their algorithms and get into their own bubbles. That is completely different, a completely different bubble than the political or media establishment. And these bubbles don't even touch again. They never reach each other again, and they start seeing each other as inherent enemies, not as two different sides of an important and complex argument, but basically an enemy that needs to be defeated. And words like racist or genocide or anti-Semitism or anything like that gets thrown out there, and there is no longer any possibility for genuine communication between those two. And we cannot underestimate the importance of social media in that regard, right? Because if in the 60s you were a student protester, maybe you saw in the newspaper the following day a picture of Dr. King protesting on a bridge, and that would be inspirational to you. Maybe you would read a quote from Dr. King, and you think, oh, this is someone I want to follow. This is someone that I believe in. But now, every 2 minutes, you get a new video of how horrible the other side is and how hateful the other side is. And that builds a fake righteousness in your own belief system that makes it almost impossible to connect to the complexity from the other side.
Well, in this case of today's episode, right, the other side are the universities. And so you will see videos of basically, right, students being kicked out of university or being suspended. And then, usually the presence of the university, maybe, right, I mean, they're talking to the students, maybe they say something wrong, something is taken out of context, and immediately there's big anger. And this against the expectation that universities are supposed to be the engine for change, right? I mean, the changes are usually coming from that new intellectual generation that will hopefully have great ideas and plans on where to take society to.
Exactly, and that is exactly the problem here. Just like then those protesters see those images, the establishment, because I don't think that the universities themselves are the only targets. So the students target universities as a proxy for the broader political establishment, right? I mean, it's not simply about, hey, you as a university need to divest in Israel. No. It's about you as a university are too comfortable with the politicians. You're too comfortable with the mainstream media. And so those universities and the general public that is more on the side of the establishment, if you like, sees images of people with masks throwing some rocks at the university, and these two sides will never ever meet again. Whereas, exactly as you said, universities are supposed to be this bulwark of thinking, of analysis, and yes, of slightly left of center improvement of the world. Universities, just like the media, are supposed to be engines for change. Why? Because once you start analyzing the world and you start reporting on the world, you start seeing problems in the world and you try to offer solutions to that. So throughout history, universities have been an engine for political, philosophical, economic change, and that's a very good thing. The difference with 2024 is that there's no serious conversation about what a change should look like. It is about anger, and it is about a very specific, narrow policy without seeing the bigger picture.
What's the international relations context?
It leads to an increasing generational right drift apart from each other. And this becomes an increasing problem, right? Because, I mean, the more disenfranchised the youth is, the less interest they will have in maintaining the system.
Yeah, and especially, and I'm sorry for using slightly cheesy words here, but because there's no love in this conversation, you know, it's all about hatred, it's about anger, it's not about connecting to each other, it's not about trying to find a uniting message, unite the different groups. This drift apart is a very significant problem, especially within a West that is already under decay, that is already in trouble, and that doesn't seem to be able to formulate a message about who it wants to be. There are no conversations about, okay, what does this actually mean? Where do we want to go with this? Those conversations are not possible in this kind of angry, hateful environment.
No, not at all. They are not at all possible. And I mean, so I've mentioned this anecdote a few times already on the podcast. And I do want to bring it up again because this always reminds me of one of the conversations or talks I attended in my very first year of university. When I was invited to attend a talk with the German ambassador to Spain. I remember there a business student sitting in the back and then asking the ambassador, is like basically saying that Germany doesn't really have a 5 or 10 year plan. It doesn't really have a vision. Any company that doesn't have a 5 or 10 or 15 year vision is going to be bankrupt in 3. Why don't we have one? And I remember disregarding that as a stupid business student. Stop talking about your business things. I care about the world and what we think about. But I mean, the more and more we talk about these things, the more I see how this man, with his stupid business perspective, right, was right. He was absolutely right. I mean, we don't really have these 5, 10, 15, 25, 50-year plans. At least no one has communicated this plan to me. Maybe they are somewhere secretly, right? But I am not aware of them, and nor are the students who are being angry at these universities and protesting.
Yeah, and that's where what the current generation, and if you like the previous generation, I always forget which generation is which, whether I am Generation X or I have no idea. But it's my generation and the generation before me that's responsible for that. That's responsible for that lack of vision that has basically has been riding on the coattails of previous generations, if you like the post-Second World War generations. And they my generation and previous thought, okay, we can just sit back and we don't need to have any thought process about the end of the 21st century. It's fine, we figured it out. And that can be also seen in many ways in this conversation about Israel, right? Because the one clear IR impact here is that slowly over time, Israel will be able to depend less on Western support because the older generations die out and younger generations have less patience with Israel. Younger generations don't remember the Holocaust. They don't remember the Second World War. They don't remember the reasons why older generations feel loyalty towards Israel. And no one is having a conversation, at least not in Europe. Okay, what does it mean? How can we reestablish a relationship with Palestinians and a relationship with the Israelis that is durable, that has a long-lasting identity? No one is having that conversation. It's all about now this or now that. It's all about whether the West needs to completely withdraw its relationship from Israel, whether the West needs to support Israel no matter what. There is no conception of a very different 30, 40-year foreign policy that Israel is going to see from Western nations.
Not at all. And we also see this generational change within Israel, right? I mean, when we observe the country, it is now increasingly in its little bunker mentality, right? I mean, you've talked about this also in previous episodes where a lot of contacts I have into Israel from my time as studying there. A lot of them who used to be very much on the left side of the spectrum and very skeptical, particularly of the Netanyahu government and particularly of the settlement policies, they're now posting and talking about things that they really didn't talk about 2 years ago, right? So now you have this bunker mentality within Israel, and that is also a change, right? That because that wasn't the case 50, 60 years ago.
No, and it's something that I find almost paradoxical. Well, some of it can be explained by demographic changes, but a lot of it is also much more subtle sociological and psychological, that a nation in the 50s and 60s that genuinely didn't know if it was going to survive the future. You know, if you lived in Israel in the 1960s, you genuinely could fear for the survival of your state. That society was much more open and much less aggressive towards, if you like, occupied Palestine, towards settlements, than the current generation, which can basically breathe a sigh of relief saying, hey, you know what? At the very minimum, Israel will continue to exist. We don't have to worry anymore. You could pinpoint in 1978 as the moment that Egypt recognized Israel, as the moment that Israel could breathe a sigh of relief and say, ooh, okay, at least we're no longer existentially threatened in the sense that the state is no longer going to disappear anytime soon. But instead of then that leading to a relaxation and sort of a broader conversation about what is now our future relationship with Palestinians, what are the rights of Palestinians, can we now critically look at our own behavior from the past decades? Israel has bunkered up and has become way more aggressive and way more hostile towards the Palestinian cause. And to me, that is, I mean, it's fascinating, but also kind of disturbing.
And can you explain to our listeners what is the problem?
Very disturbing indeed. And that kind of leads us to the disturbing status quo we're looking at. So we already talked about this generational shift or basically drift apart, that there are no longer any constructive conversations happening about where we want to be. So not within the West towards, hey, where does the West want to be? But neither within Israel, where Israel basically wants to be, except in its little bunker, at least the way it seems to be right now.
Well, but this then ties into this Western problem that Israel has, right? So at the very minimum, Israel seems to understand that they have to kind of start practically preparing for a world where the West, especially given what we see at universities now, the West might no longer have its back all of the time. And so you see Israel connecting to Saudi Arabia, Israel connecting definitely to Russia, China, Turkey, not natural allies. And that is now completely thrown away. All that hard work from the past two decades that Israel put in, at least at a foreign policy level, knowing that the West is changing its approach, has now been burned down over the past 6 months. And all these countries I just listed will now no longer do business with Israel, which is a huge problem for Israel, because that means that they have to rely on a West that is in its own, if you like, conflict about this whole topic.
Very much in its own conflict. And then about this topic, and again, let's take this back to the case study at hand at the university level. One of the things that we've criticized in the bubble, and we've criticized throughout this whole podcast series, is then that managerial attitude that institutions in particular have towards this, right? It's only about, how can we be on the right side when it comes to communications, right? How can we kick the students off campus without all these videos going online? Maybe we can offer them something, right? I mean, so some of the solutions that some of these encampments basically have reached is the university is offering basically 5 Palestinian students to study at the university for free. Oh, well, yeah, that's going to solve the problem, right? I mean, that's amazing for these 5 individuals, and I hope that they will take all the chances to come from that, but it's not necessarily addressing any of the problems that the students, are facing or basically bringing forward to the university. So I think that's the best examples we've had so far in this whole series of a managerial attitude towards these problems.
Yeah, and so it seems that half of what universities are supposed to do is missing here. So one half is being this bulwark for change, which we mentioned before, thinking about the problems in this world, offering solutions, sometimes radical solutions. That's all fine. But the other half is intellectualism. It is actually visionary conversations. It's embracing the complexity of the world. It is trying to understand things that people who just have jobs and don't have time to go to university because they're older and they already went, or maybe they don't have interest in going to universities, they cannot think about because they've got other things to do. As a student, as a professor at university, what your job is to understand the world in its full complexity. And that has completely disappeared. These conversations that we're seeing at universities right now, if you can even call them conversations, are actually completely devoid of any significant academic or intellectual meaning. It's all about the emotions. It's all about the anger. It's all about calling the other side out. And it is not at all about connecting to what a university is supposed to do, namely understand the world.
And based off that understanding, then having a vision for the world, right? Explaining a vision for the world. And I mean, that's something where universities are now becoming, again, they're also teaching managerial aspects, right? It's no longer about how can I understand the world and its complexities, but it's about how can I perform best in the job market, right? A whole class on CV writing, a whole class on, I don't know, business management, a whole class on, I don't know, how to deal with this, how to deal with that, but no class on, okay, let's be radical here for a moment in our thought experiment. If you could rebuild society, where would you want to take it? Is democracy still the right model for us? If so, why? If not, then what would you change about it, right? These are conversations that are not necessarily being held at universities, and they're also not being taught, right? This attitude of, okay, critically thinking about this, that's no longer there. It's now really about, okay, how can I play the system? How can I write the best LinkedIn post telling the world how humble and grateful I am to accept this position?
Yeah, and exactly as you put it before, that means that universities have become one of the worst victims of this managerial change, where now going to university is just a path to get a job. That's it. You go to university so because it looks good on your CV, and maybe you learn some skills that you can then can use when you become a middle manager. Congratulations. That takes away the value of universities as bulwarks of in that intellectualism that I mentioned, bulwarks of that analysis, that understanding. Theoretically, certainly in the past, you would go to university not as a preparation directly for a job, but simply to expand your horizons, to understand the world better. You would study Latin or philosophy or history, not because Latin or philosophy or history are a path towards becoming rich, but because you believe in the value of general knowledge and broad understanding. And that is basically completely being eradicated from universities worldwide. And students are being asked to pay insane amounts of money for the right to go to university. And in exchange, they demand access to the good jobs, because otherwise they will never be able to pay back their student debt. And as a result, any kind of interest in broad academic questions gets replaced by how can you be attractive to Microsoft, or how can you be attractive to the United Nations, or how can you be attractive to a job that pays well? And that is then reflected in the complete lack of serious conversations when it comes to Israel and Palestine, when it comes to these issues. And you can see how these young people are no longer driven by intellectualism, and universities are no longer teaching them intellectualism, no longer teaching them academic values. It just becomes a clash between managerial attitudes and young generations feeling uncomfortable with that.
And what now?
So based on what you just said, we should definitely have a conversation about, okay, what's our foreign policy going to be towards Israel, towards Gaza, towards Palestine? But we are not, at least in universities, I can look into every classroom, but we are not having these conversations, particularly not after these protests. But lucky for us, we are going to have one of those conversations, not necessarily about what are we going to do with Israel-Palestine, but we're going to have a conversation about, hey, what are we going to do with our foreign policy institutions? Because just like the universities, they are in the decline.
Yeah, absolutely. And those two are very much related, right? I mean, as a professor of international relations, it is very clear that these conversations about that foreign policy, about the broader issues, are no longer being had sufficiently. And when you do have them, as I myself also noticed in the classroom over the past 6 months, they lead to anger and they lead to outrage, and sometimes between students, sometimes towards the professor. And so the message here really is that if universities want to do what they're supposed to do, which is provide broad understanding and knowledge to the world, provide solutions to the world, that requires all of us at university, but also outside of university, to actually have these complex conversations again, to educate each other on different perspectives. You feel outraged by the protesters? Try to understand and analyze their perspective rather than judge them. You feel outraged by the establishment, by universities, by politicians, by the media, the pro-Israeli side? Try to understand them, connect with them, have serious conversations without being infected by social media, without believing that you are fighting some kind of righteous war against an evil enemy. Connect. Do what universities, academia, and intellectualism are all about. Understand that the world is a complex place, and be humble in your position with respect to that complexity, and continue to learn and continue to grow. What does that mean for you, and what does that mean for the world in the next 50 years? Those are the questions you're supposed to have.
Well, and as a former student, being very close to students, I feel like I have the right to give some advice. I don't know if I have the right, but I'm just going to take it. Right, and that very much goes along the lines of, hey, take some time, right? Put down your phone, sit down with your friends. I mean, those for me were the best university nights or evenings anyways, right? You sit down with your friends over, if you're European, over a good bottle of wine. If you're American, buy a European bottle of wine. And you sit down, you just have these conversations about the future, right? You talk, you pick a topic, maybe not Israel, Palestine, and just have a discussion of where you want to take the world. And it doesn't need to be realistic, but at least think about it. And I mean, maybe, hey, no taboos whatsoever. Just take the conversation wherever it leads you. And I mean, never know where you might end up.
Indeed, and be humble in that conversation and don't feel comfortable calling other people anti-Semitic or racist or genocidal. Listen, and you know, it seems like a very cheesy kind of message, right? But listen to each other and try to understand where they're coming from, because unless you believe that the person you're talking to is a psychopath, your job certainly as a young person is to understand that person, to see where they're coming from and why their perspectives are so different from yours. That is the key, and that is where universities have been failing lately, and where also students are currently failing.
Well, this seems like a great moment to end today's conversation on the institutional decline of universities. If you have any questions, comments, or you heard a mistake that we made throughout the episode, please make sure to send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com, and we will try to incorporate them in our following episodes. Thank you very much to the listeners for joining us today. Make sure to join us again next week when we press the Western Bubble. That is it from my side. Balder, which closing quote did you pick for us today?
Well, this is a quote very much in line with my final words just before. It's from Oppenheimer. Everyone knows him now because of the film. And he said, "No man should escape our universities without knowing how little he knows."